generally unanimous consent that this was a good idea to go back to the way it was, so that there wouldn't simply be a hardship on this small group, that we can address this subsidy issue in a broader way over the next few years.
So, Mr. Chair, I have actually two more questions. So, in essence, what you're saying is it's back at the UI Council, and they're trying to figure out how to better address this issue so that it is fair, but it's fair to the employee and to the employer. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Gustis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's fair to say, and the Advisory Council is going to be looking at this, I think, over the next few years, because the what we call the maximum-rated, experience-rated employers are currently being subsidized to the tune of $100 million a year from across the program. So all other employers who pay unemployment insurance taxes subsidize these maximum-rated employers. And we're not just talking about small seasonal businesses, but we're also talking about large construction companies, landscaping businesses, any businesses that are currently at the maximum rate and are benefiting from that subsidy.
Mr. Chair, and this is a question for the author or for the chair. Did you say that this is moving to the tax committee? Is that where we're moving it to?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, that is correct.
The mighty chairman of the tax committee said he would like to hear this bill.
Interesting.
Don't you wish he was yours?
Mr. Chair, has an unemployment bill ever gone to the tax committee? I mean, I don't, in my 10 years, I don't know of one.
He thinks this is such a good bill, he wants to hear it.
I'm always happy to accommodate a chair, but it just seems odd.
Okay, well, Representative Dill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And first, an editorial comment. I think that the problem is well described here in so-called gaming the system. I think it's the job of this committee and our counterparts in the Senate, the governor, and the legislature as a whole to actually create economic opportunity so that we don't have a gaming of the system. Because I can tell you that the wages that are paid to these kids, I have one, I own a resort, I know how much I pay my son, and it's not a living wage, actually. Because, I mean, he couldn't possibly live on what I pay him. I mean, it's just not possible. I mean, but, yeah, well, it's what it is. It's an industry. I mean, you know, it's what it is out in those rural areas. And, you know, really, we need to have a new economic opportunity, and we certainly have the opportunity in the Northeast with all the projects staring us in the face. We just have to get through the permitting process. But that editorial statement is going to be followed by, can you put a number figure on what you think the gaming of the system? I heard you mention a number a moment ago. I missed what you said, but could you put a number figure on what the gaming of the system, as you described it, costs the UI fund?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I can't put a number on it. That information is more anecdotal. But the issue of the subsidy overall is another issue that the Advisory Council has looked at. They looked at several proposals to address the subsidy this year, and none of those were adopted. But the subsidy itself is approximately $100 million. $75 million of benefits are paid to workers of employers at the max rate each year, and you know the tax is $75 million, and about $175 million in benefits are paid to those workers.
Mr. Gustafson, how many weeks of unemployment insurance do these adult relatives of the owner get compared to someone else? The same number?
Under current law, Mr. Chair, the adult children of business owners are now limited to 5 weeks of state unemployment benefits and 11 weeks on the federal extensions. Now, if they do have the $7,500 of wages in each of the past 16 calendar quarters prior to establishing a benefit account, they have up to 26 weeks of state benefits and up to 86 weeks total.
Now, it's my understanding that if they they're eligible for 16 weeks if they don't have those calendar quarters, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So they get 16 weeks versus 26 weeks for someone else. So they still are subject to a 10-week penalty because they are an adult child of an owner. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair. It would be 16 weeks versus the possibility of up to 86 weeks with the federal extensions. So they get, if it makes sense, Mr. Chair, they get a portion 5 out of 26 state, you know, and then mm-hmm. we do a proportional on the federal extension, so it's 11 out of 86, or 11 out of those additional extended benefit weeks. Okay. So you go from 86 weeks down to a potential of 16 weeks.
Representative Dill, you get your questions in?
I don't have any more questions. I'd like to pass the bill.
Okay. Anybody else? Representative Scalzi.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm more interested in the number of the cost to the trust fund, because that's not just free and easy money. That's money that little companies like mine pay into. And I don't ever lay anybody off, but consequently I probably don't hire because of the threat of a possible layoff when business is down. But that's good money that's come out of a lot of good businesses. So I guess I'm concerned the $1.5 to $2 million a year to me sounds like a real lot of money. And so what is the status of that fund at this date?
Mr. Gusterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the trust fund currently is in deficit status to the tune of about approximately $600 million. The $1.5 to $2 million we consider a pretty minor amount, considering we paid out last year $2.8 billion in unemployment benefits to Minnesotans.
Representative Scalzi.
Can you tell me then how we're going to get that unemployment trust fund out of deficit status? Is there any plan for that? Is there going to be an increase on, say, my little tiny business to help that fund get larger?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, built into the state law currently is a fix for that. The state trust fund is used to going into deficit in recessionary periods, and built right into the law is a fix so that taxes on employers do go up to make up that deficit. And we currently project, our numbers yesterday actually currently project that we will go out of deficit by the end of 2013.
Business goals.
So then I would say that my little commentary on this, being one who pays into that and never uses it, is that I don't like to subsidize other people that use it repeatedly and repeatedly, repeatedly. I would say that, you know, somebody could use it maybe one time, but not next year again. It becomes a habit. And I don't like to subsidize bad habits. That's just my own commentary on this situation.
Mr. Gustafson, isn't it true that people that use unemployment insurance seasonally and often pay more than somebody that doesn't? Their rate is higher because of their experience?
Mr. Chair, the employer pays a higher experience rating based on the amount of benefits paid out to its workers.
Like a seasonal construction company would be one of those.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
As an addendum to that, but only until they reach the maximum. So if the maximum base rate is 8.9%, then they could continually do this every year and still not get above the 8.9%. So then that would necessitate a subsidy from the other businesses who don't do that.
That's what the $100 million they talked about. Representative Dill.
Well, converse to that, Mr. Chairman, would be a person who never lays off someone like Representative Scalzi, who pays what rate? What if the 8.9 is what, let's just pick a resort owner pays, what would someone who had employees that never lays on it? It's about 2% of payroll, as I remember, 2.5, 2.7, is that, what is the number?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I'm not exactly sure of the number. Maybe Keith Goodwin could answer that. He's our unemployment insurance director. I think it's a very low percentage, though.
Good afternoon. Goodwin, Keith Goodwin, unemployment insurance director. Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, the base rate is currently 0.05, and then because of some supplemental things that get added on, it's probably about 0.068. So those employers that don't have a experience rating. So essentially it's what the law is designed to do is has a base rate. Every employer pays that, period. Then you have stacked on that 8.9 up to what we call the experience rating, 8.9%. And then during times when we are in deficit, we have some supplemental add-ons to help bring it out of deficit. So we have a lot of employers that, of course, are at the what we call the minimum rate. We have 125,000 or so employers, and I'm guessing over half of them probably at the minimum rate.
Representative Dale.
We're debating what he just said, Mr. Chairman. So did I hear that the rate for the lowest payer of unemployment benefits is less than 1%?
Correct.
Okay, I want to commend you, Representative Scalzi, for your good work. I mean, you're getting a real bargain on the unemployment, and you're employing people, and that's something to be really proud of.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I'm just kind of curious, because it seems to me that just went up this year, and maybe this is the recessionary increase. But
it did. And if you look at percentages, it went from 0.04 to 0.05 in the base rate. So one-tenth, that is a 20% increase, obviously, 0.04 to 0.05. And so if you are a base rate employer, it became a little more visible. And that's partially that's driven by the law on trust fund balances. I think there's been several questions about the trust fund. It's been put in place extensive legal outlines about how to proceed. And so really and you may have questions about that periodically. What are we going to do about that? It's all built in. This issue of borrowing from the federal government during deficits, there's certainly, I think, 31 or 33 states in that category right now. It happens, unfortunately, during recessions. This is a fairly significant recession. It's happened before, and there is a mechanism to come out, and it will come out. But it is not a zero sum. I mean, it has to be paid for ultimately by employers, simply because it's a social insurance program.
Seeing no question. Representative Murray renews his motion to have House File 103 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried.
Thank you.
Great job. Now, we are honored to have a little overview on unemployment insurance. We did. Courtesy of a lot of your questions. You starting?
Yep.
Okay, Mr. Gustafson. We're looking forward to learning all kinds of wonderful pearls of wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, for the record, my name is Craig Gustafson. I'm with the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Unemployment Insurance Program. Members, if you look at this handout stated titled Minnesota Unemployment Insurance Program Overview for 2011, that's the handout we'll be quickly going through. Mr. Chair, the Unemployment Insurance Program is a federal-state program that was established in 1936. Its purpose is to provide workers who are unemployed through no fault of their own a temporary partial wage replacement to assist the unemployed worker to become reemployed. The administration of the Unemployment Insurance Program is fully federally funded. It's contingent on Minnesota law conforming to federal requirements, and Minnesota administering the Unemployment Insurance Program in a manner consistent with those federal requirements. Mr. Chair, the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council looks at issues facing the Unemployment Insurance Program each year. We meet about 4 to 5 times in the late summer, early fall. Council discusses proposed legislation from the department and other interested groups. House members include Representative Gunther, Representative Murdoch, and Representative Dabney. The members of the council are appointed by the commissioner. Program volume in the unemployment insurance program. As of December 31st of 2010, we had 370,000 new applications for benefits in the year. You can see those numbers for yourself. I won't go read them through. We had, as I told Representative Scales before, we had $2.8 billion were paid out in benefits last year to 348,780 Minnesotans. In a non-recessionary year, the last one we had, we paid out $700 million So you can see the swing between a non-recession to a recessionary year is quite dramatic. Our weekly payments are about over $50 million per week. In a non-recessionary year, they average $14 million per week. We have 132,000 active employers in the state who pay approximately $900 million in state unemployment insurance taxes. As you can see from the UI tax overview on page 3, the second box, our average tax on employers' total payroll is currently below the national average. However, Minnesota is the most seasonal state in the nation and is the most experience rated for UI tax purposes. So as we were discussing with House File 103, the low end and the high end, that gap is the highest of any state in the nation for unemployment taxes. Employers pay UI taxes on the first $27,000 of wages paid. Taxes vary by employer based on the amount of unemployment benefits paid to an employer's workers. The cost of unemployment benefits are postpaid, not prepaid. That's a common misconception. People will call us up and say, I paid my premiums, I should get my benefits. No, benefits are postpaid. You do pay a certain minimum rate all the time, but if you lay off an employee, you pay those benefits that employee collected over the next 4 years. As far as our customers go, 85 to 90% of new applications and weekly requests are currently on the internet. 95% of employer transactions now are done on the web. Nearly all payments made by employers and to applicants are done electronically at this point. Our staff handled over 1.2 million phone calls last year. Our staff issued over 280,000 eligibility determinations last year, and our unemployment law judges conducted over 34,000 appeal hearings on eligibility and other issues in 2010. As we discussed with House File 103, there is a trust fund solvency issue currently due to the recession that we are experiencing. Minnesota is one of 31 states that are currently borrowing a total of approximately $41 billion from the federal government at the end of 2010 in order to pay regular state unemployment insurance benefits. As of January 22nd of this year, we had a negative balance of $607 million in the UI Trust Fund. For comparison purposes, Wisconsin currently has a negative balance of $1.4 billion. As I said before, the trust fund is projected to have a positive balance by the end of 2013. To address this issue of recurring trust fund deficits during recessionary periods in 2002, the legislature took action. They changed the experience rating period from 5 years to 4 years. They added a supplemental assessment and did a few other provisions to address this. Prior to this recession, there was not enough time period between those changes and the recession in 2008 to build a substantial enough reserve to pay for the benefits through this recession. On page 6, you'll see the chart describing what benefits are available, the maximum amount of benefits. You can't really see it on the printout, but regular state UI is up to 26 weeks of benefits. There are three tiers of federal emergency unemployment compensation, known as EUC. Tier 1 is up to 20 weeks, Tier 2 is up to 14 weeks, and Tier 3 is up to 13 weeks. And the federal state extended benefit program, which we discussed in House File 103, is up to an additional 13 weeks. If you have any questions after the meeting, if you didn't think of anything, feel free to email or call myself or Keith Goodwin, our Unemployment Insurance Director, Lee Nelson, our legal counsel. He's in Florida today, so he'd be what?
Unemployment?
No. He'd be happy to answer your questions as well. And Lynn Batsley is our Legislative Director. I'm sure most of you know her. She would be happy to answer your questions. She's at the Capitol every day during session.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. When you say you have a $607 million negative balance, where do you get the money then to pay the current weekly benefits?
We are required, of course, to pay weekly benefits regardless of the trust fund. So we borrow from the federal government, and that's what all of the states are borrowing. There's one state that's considering a bonding thing, which is a complicated equation. And we borrow, and then there's rules on payback. There has been the borrowing thus far We went into deficit in March of 2009. Has been interest-free. There was a proposal in the legislature to make that interest-free for another year. I'm talking about Congress, excuse me. That did not pass as part of the legislation in December that President Obama signed. So we have to cover that interest cost. It's I don't want to ever say millions of dollars are relatively cheap. It's estimated around $16 million this year. And there's already a 2% assessment put on employers in our tax rate notices last fall. The Commissioner of Finance and the Commissioner of Deed had to set that by statute. And that was set in late October of 2010. So it's all done. There's a special funding mechanism that deals with that.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up? Mr. Chairman, a follow-up?
Representative House.
How often then do you borrow from the federal government? If you see you're going to be short $150 million, do you borrow $250 million so you have enough to go another month or two?
No.
Or how does that work?
It's a daily transaction amount. We don't pay any interest. We don't have to. So every day the books are revised. So it's called a sweep. So we will sweep through every day, and it will be done every day. For example, this, for those who may or may not know this, this happens to be a wage detail filing month for employers. We get filed employers' taxes four times a year. Because of the way the taxable wage base works, $27,000, for those employees that have substantially more than $27,000, obviously a higher proportion of the taxes are paid in the first quarter. So historically it runs 40, 30, 20, 10. So we get 40% of our total taxes in late April, right in that time frame, 30%. We are now in the 10% phase, meaning we're going to be getting 10% max estimated. So that's how it's paid. And I guess, Representative Howe, did you have another question? I've forgotten what it was.
No, I think that you answered pretty close. But I would like to, Mr. Chairman, just ask if the trust fund is healthy, has any state agency ever tried to borrow from it?
You can't borrow from it by federal law.
Answer my question.
Yeah, the feds would view that very dimly. It's in the trust fund. We would have to call them, and then they basically say, "You need to talk to somebody, or you're fired," or something like that. We have
good. I have a question that I'd like to ask.
Hope you're not getting outside of our.
You know, one state wants to bond for this deficit. I believe the interest rate that we pay the feds is 3.8%.
Actually, we just got the interest rate. We haven't seen it in black and white yet. We were in a conference call with Washington a few days ago, and we were told it was 4.083 or something like that.
Even worse.
Pardon?
Bonding rate, I'm sure, would be in the area of 1% if a state had any kind of credit rating at all. Is there anything prohibiting us to going to Wells Federal and say, what kind of interest rate would you charge us for it so we don't have to borrow the money from the federal government?
That question was posed today. We're not, as of this second, aware that there's anything that prohibits that. I don't know whether you can successfully get. You're talking about bond now, or are you talking about general loan rates?
Either one.
Yeah.
Loans.
You know, 4.08 is pretty low, but rates are pretty low now. And
for an individual, yes. Yeah, but for a
government,
state of Minnesota, I don't think it's that low.
Yeah. You're getting into areas where we'd have to give more thought. We need to talk to the federal government about that. What was the question, Craig, that was posed about 2 weeks ago by Anita? Remember the issue of can the state, I've forgotten it. We went to the feds and they said no. Remember what that was about 10 days ago? Anyway, we estimate the interest this year will be about $16 million. We estimate, this is kind of complicated, we have to pay the interest of the loan by September 30th of this year. And we really only have two quarters to work with, first quarter and second quarter. So the interest rate was set at 2%, which is the lowest allowed by law. It is set by statute between 2 and 8. In the bill that is not here today, but in what we believe to be the department bill, we are going to ask a legislative authority to pass a law that would permit the commissioner of the departments to do it below 2% if the circumstances warrant that, because 2% sometimes will be too rich of an assessment. But that's not before you today.
Okay, we're looking forward to your answer whether the federal government will let us borrow that money. It's my understanding that it is a constitutional issue about bonding for the money in the state of Minnesota. But borrowing, I think we think we can. But we'd like to know what the federal government says. And we'd appreciate you getting back to this us with that money. 2% of $500 million, soon to probably be $1 billion, is not chump change. Representative Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on one of the, on one of your points here in this pamphlet. It says the cost of unemployment benefits are postpaid, not prepaid. The employer, through an increase in its experience rating over 4 years, repays the cost. So, so if I have a business that doesn't lay anybody off, my experience rating could still go up because of the cap on the 8.9% and the subsidies that the businesses with the lower experience rating are paying. What was it? Almost $2.50 for every dollar that those that are maxed out are paying. So would that make an experience rating go up for those that don't lay people off?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lemire, if you don't lay anybody off, you're going to be what is called the minimum rate. So that generally stays pretty constant year to year, subject to the status of the trust fund. If we're in deficit, then there's a formula in law. So you don't have what is called an experience rating because you've not laid anybody off. And so you have the base rate. You might ask, well, why does the base rate even exist? This is because some employers go out of business. And if they're out of business, of course, they can't pay taxes over the next 4 years. So we have to have some cost that is borne by the entire system. We have, obviously, the higher experience-rated employers. If it's above 8.9%, that's another factor. We have some charges that, by law, a person is entitled to benefits, but the employer does not get charged for it as a matter of public policy. For example, if you had to leave a job for valid medical reasons, but you were still able, let's say you were, just by way of example, let's say you were sensitive to certain kinds of fumes, and your doctor said you had to leave because that employer had a business that really had fume exposure, but you could still work in other jobs, you, assuming you meet other terms of eligibility, would be entitled to benefits, but that employer would not be charged because that employer did not make the decision to separate the employment, if you follow what I'm saying.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of talk about experience rating and your 2% or 8.9. When you're figuring that experience rating, how far back do you go to determine a layoff? Is it in the past year, the past 5 years, the past 10 years?
The you saw in the presentation it went from 5 years to 4 years a few years ago. Basically, the tax rates that went out in December of this year by law, your experience rated portion of the tax, if you pay, if your employer has paid benefits, is determined on the period ending June 30th of 2010 and starting July 1, 2006, if my math is correct. In other words, it's a four-way look, and what you do is over that, all set by law, you look over that four-year window, and you look at total taxable wages, that's a denominator, and you look at total benefits paid, that's the numerator, and there's a formula, and that's what generates what we call the experience rating, and it's a formula that based operations. So it's 4 years, and what happens is, because of the way the formula works, the first year would be probably pre-recession. And so as we move further on, that first year is going to drop off, be replaced with a recession year. That's what causes the taxes to trend up. Then as we come out of recession, it will trend down.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Just so I'm, so I know I'm understanding correctly. You look back a certain number of years for the employee to make sure they've made X number of dollars in order to get the full benefits, a number of quarters, actually.
Correct.
And for the employers, you look back, as you're making up their experience rating, you look back a total of 4 years to make sure that they have, you know, that they have laid someone off or not laid someone off. And it just changed, I think, a year or two ago from 5 years of look back to 4 years of look back. Is that correct?
That's right.
Thank you.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Gunther, and we've really very learned an awful lot here today. Even as an employer, I've learned a lot. It makes, you know, seems to make sense to me. What I'm wondering is, how do you pay your bills?
How do we pay our bills, our administrative costs?
Right, correct.
It comes out of the federal government.
I didn't see that in the presentation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, we have an administrative grant from the Department of Labor. Every state does. And it's, as you, as the employers in the room would know, you also pay federal unemployment tax. It's called FUTA. And as long as the state has in place a state statute that meets the federal guidelines, the FUTA charge is I want to say 5.6% of 7,000 on each employee. And but there's a portion of that is set aside for administrative costs. So the administrative costs are ultimately, obviously, borne by the employers. It's a social insurance system. The federal government manages all the fiscal stuff. So even when those taxes pay in, it sits in a federal fund. And Minnesota has a count. You know, they, and we sweep through that every day to make payments. And if we have ability to have some fund balance to pay the interest on, we sweep that out too.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. I always wondered where FUTA went. I've been paying it for a few decades and just wondered exactly where it went. Yeah. But so you don't have it a general fund appropriation?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Not for the unemployment insurance tax, unemployment insurance program. It's a federal state program, and we're pretty heavily looked at by the federal government.
Mr. Gustafson, just out of curiosity, we have the UI bill that comes to employers. At the same time, there's a dislocated workers bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct.
Could you do any explanation to the members about how much the dislocated workers bill is? And because it's very often buried because of the UI bill and people don't even know they're paying it, what does it do? And I know it goes at a varying rate. Right now it's 1.2, I believe. Yep. Either one of you.
Mr. Chairman, basically we collect, because we have the mechanisms for collecting, it's added on to the UI tax. So it's a 0.101, now went to 0.12. And that technically is not money that belongs to the trust fund as such. It belongs to whatever the legislature decides it belongs to. And it's used for currently, parts of it, I think, for the dislocated worker fund, to serve dislocated workers.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. In terms of the overall bill that goes out to employers, it's a pretty small segment of it. Pretty small segment.
I believe it's primarily for job training for the next employee, and my understanding is it's a program that's working very well. Employees that are laid off get hired at 80% of the rate that they had before they were laid off in an average of 12 weeks. So where it's something employers don't necessarily, 24 out of 25 employers that I called didn't know they were paying it. It does work very well, even though it's hidden, UI bill. So, Representative House?
No, pass.
Okay. Representative Murray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goodwin, just kind of curiosity for me, with $600 million in debt and climbing, where does the state unemployment rate, and I understand there's a lot of variables, but where does the state unemployment rate have to get to that we kind of have a crossing point where what's coming in the door and what's going out the door is the same?
Well, that depends. First of all, the state unemployment rate announced Thursday of last week is 7.0. It reached as high, if my memory serves me correctly, 8.4% in the summer of 2009. It's been on generally on a slow decline, and we're running you know, knock on wood here, I don't want to ever say 7% is good, but comparatively speaking, we're a lot better than almost all states in our size. And so we are The answer isn't really what the unemployment rate. The issue is what's the benefit payouts, and of course that is affected by unemployment, and the tax receipts. We anticipate this year, 2013, that actually the tax receipts will slightly exceed payouts. So we're not continuing to, if the right word is from a trust fund perspective, bleed. We're reversing that trend, but you don't dig out of that hole in 2 months or two quarters. It takes a while. And the mechanism is in place to dig out of that hole. For the benefit of the committee, we've been in holes before. Actually, in 82, we were, comparatively speaking, in a bigger hole. When I say bigger hole, it wasn't quite the same amount of money, but of course, 19 gross dollars. But 1982 is 28 years ago, so I think we were $280 or $300 million in the hole then. That's a much bigger proportional number than now. So it's just a function of tax receipts and what labor management, LMI Division of D, does some prognostication, and we looked at it again yesterday. And Steve Hine, who you might hear quoted in the paper periodically, is an economist that does his PhD economist with his staff. We went through that yesterday, and that's the current projections are that we will see benefit payouts continue to drop a little, and receipts will increase. Now, I'm going to tell you something I think is good for you to hear, and that is this. Remember when we said 2009 we had $2.8 billion paid out, and 2010, coincidentally, we had $2.8 billion paid out. But the mix of that is dramatically different. In 2009, $1.7 billion of that was state-funded. In 2010, only $1.24 billion was state-funded. What does that mean? In a recession, if you think, looking at calendars, when you have a loss of jobs of a significant amount for a rapid pace, which started late fall of 2008, the first 26 weeks sit there. And so the state fund picks up that burden. As a person migrates into the other levels of benefits, the federal government kicks those in. A couple other things I think is worth for you to consider. We have, as we know already, a highly seasonal business. So we, in a non-recessionary period, 2006, let's say, we would have about what we call 40,000 weeks of benefits requested in September, October. That tends to be our low water mark every year. And by the mid-January, February, it was 85,000. That's the swing, pretty much, of seasonal workers coming in, 45,000 or so. If you look at, remember what I said, 85,000 in January? Last week here, it was 103,000 regular. So while the total benefits were 174,000, it was only 103,000. So all the trend lines look better than what we thought they would be a year and a half ago. Because if you do the ratio of 85 to 103, you know, quick math for the math whizzes in here, is whatever it is, it's going to be 1.25. Well, if you take an interest, excuse me, an unemployment rate of whatever, let's say at that time it was 5 to, and do the math to 7, you'll see similar kinds of ratios. So compared to where we thought we were going to be, I don't want to ever describe this for the purpose of the individual who's unemployed, which is very significant, and certain industries, are, as we know, are very significant, housing and construction industries. But it's still a better picture than it was a year ago.
Representative Dill.
Well, you actually answered my question, but I have another question. Pretty simple. From what I hear you saying is that been there, done that, don't sweat it, just understand it.
Mr. Goodwin.
If you're asking Keith Goodwin personally, I would say yes. Don't sweat it too much, but there are policymakers that make decisions I'm not involved in. So the new commissioner has not had a chance to be fully briefed on that yet. And so I don't want to speak for him, although he's engaged. But the feeling is this. I think what happens is we get, you've got some big issues on your table, legislature, whatever it is, a $6.2 billion deficit. In the scheme of things, I mean, jobs. We know that's critical. But in the scheme of things, the trust fund balance is going to self-correct itself. It's going to happen. But it doesn't mean it's going to cost something.
Okay, one question that we just came up with. We're doing a lot of that, by the way. The UI tax rate buy-down program, can you describe that to us?
Yes, there's a provision in the law that permits an employer to buy down their taxes by paying a certain portion of their charges, and they don't have to pay a 25% assessment that used to be in the law for a period of time. And you kind of say, well, what's the 25% assessment? Well, because of issues of employers going out of business and other charges, the mathematical formula for paying back usually is about around 125%, because you got to cover those kinds of things. But there was an incentive put in the law to, if those employers wanted to do it, to pay off their benefits early, therefore restructure their tax rate. And certain employers will do this. Of course, it takes upfront cash to do that. But if you are an employer and you think you're going to expand your business, and therefore you're going to have a lot of wages that are going to be taxed, you might say, what I'll do is I'll pay this down to reduce that exposure in future years. If you're an employer that's declining your size, you might say, I don't want to do that. Keep in mind, if you're an employer that just goes simply out of business, you don't pay any more taxes based upon future assessments. If you owe money for some past taxes, you know, there's an issue there, of course, but future assessments don't happen because you don't have any wages.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goodwin, so how does the unemployment insurance and the dislocated worker program affect, say, a laid-off independent contractor, if at all, and how would it affect the company that hires the independent contractor
if they
apply?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, you all are identifying lots of hot issues here today. Independent contractor is a big issue. It's a big issue for unemployment insurance. It's actually probably equally a big issue for the Department of Revenue. Essentially, if you're an independent contractor, you're not covered by unemployment insurance. So we don't know about it. Now, I happen to also, Greg and I are both lawyers. A lot of employers think that if you sign a piece of document and say independent contractor on it and stamp it with a notary, they're an independent contractor. That's not the case. It is a multi-factor analysis. And so this is an issue that a group of agencies collectively are looking at. So whatever happens to independent contractor, we don't collect taxes on them. We don't pay benefits on them. But we may get a determination where someone will come in and say, I'm applying for benefits, and we'll say, well, we have no wage detail for you. And they'll say, well, I'm an employee, and we will then conduct an audit to determine if, in fact, they were an employee.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What criminal penalties are there for the employer who is doing a fraud when you catch them like that?
Well, I want to be, Mr. Chair, Representative, Mulry. Sorry, I can't see it.
Mulry.
Thank you.
Criminal law and civil law are obviously dramatically different, and so there are some provisions for misrepresentation, but I'm not aware there's a like independent contract or anything dealing with criminal law there. That's beyond a reasonable doubt, and it takes, you know, someone has to fully comprehend what they're doing, and so I think the answer is not a lot.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mulry.
What civil penalties are there? Are they substantial? Obviously, they're not enough substantial to make people not do it. Have you proposed any increase in this so that we can have something that actually works?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, Minnesota Statute Section 268.184 provides for administrative penalties and criminal penalties on employers who make false statements or representations, knowing them to be false. If the action was taken to prevent or reduce the payment of unemployment benefits, penalty can be $500 or 50% of the overpaid unemployment benefits. So if an applicant is overpaid benefits, say of $10,000, we can assess a penalty of $5,000 on that employer. Criminal penalties exist. We rarely pursue criminal action in the department based on that statute, but it has occurred in the past. The difficulty with criminal penalties is getting assistance from county attorney's office to prosecute.
Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems that this is a partnership between the federal government and the state government, this whole deal. So my question is, and I may well show my total ignorance here, is does the state pay unemployment premiums on the state employees, and does the federal government pay those same premiums on federal employees that are located in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, Minnesota is what is called a reimbursing employer. The state of Minnesota and certain nonprofits qualify for reimbursing status. That means they just pay, they don't get a tax rate as such. Every quarter they carry the full load of whatever the benefit payout is.
Okay.
So that's the Fed. Yes, in the federal we assess that we would charge back the federal government for any benefits paid federal employees.
So we'll follow up on that.
Representative Dill.
Then I recall in my city administrator days that that was an option on a local unit of government's position, that they could either choose to not pay any premiums and pay the actual payouts or pay the premiums and let you pay the payout.
If you're
is that true?
Yes. The answer is you can. Is that true in government?
Yes, that's
true. Yeah, you can elect. You're reimbursing and you can elect to be taxpaying. Okay. I would say for governmental units, very few. I don't think there's too many elect to be taxpaying, but. But nonprofits are constantly trying to figure out what's the best mix. But once you do an election, it's a two-year election. You can't
switch
all the time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, the downside to being a taxpaying employer is you do pay that 25% surcharge to pay for the administrative costs of the program. If reimbursing employers, nonprofits, governments don't pay that 25% surcharge.
So is that all nonprofits, Mr. Chair? Are they limited to 501c3s, or how's that structured?
501c3s.
Okay.
Representative Mulroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just mentioned the governments don't pay the tax, they pay it, the cost. But if a government had a huge number of seasonal employees, wouldn't it actually benefit them because of the cap to do the tax instead?
I mean, I'm not aware of situations where, well, first of all, reimbursing is reimbursing. I'm not aware of any situation where even if you went taxpaying that the government would be at 8.9%. That's a huge number. It's never come across my attention anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, there are nonprofits who do switch back and forth depending on anticipated layoffs. If a nonprofit anticipates laying off several employees in a few years, we see them switching back and forth between taxpaying and reimbursing on occasion.
Let me just my last one.
Okay.
Could you give us, Ms. Chair, could you give us a brief description of what happens when an employee is terminated for a cause and how they can draw unemployment? I have a lot of questions about that from people in my district, particularly those ones that get fired.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, the unemployment insurance law is designed structurally to, you all are making us work today, which is good, is designed to provide a benefit platform to those who are unemployed through no fault of their own. So if you think of the termination of employment, there's generally two ways employment ends. Discharge, an employer made by the decision made by the employer, or quit, decision made by an employee. If it's a discharge, the general rule under Minnesota Statute 268.095 is that you're entitled to benefits unless certain exceptions apply. One of the key exceptions is employment misconduct. So, to make an example which you would all easily identify, I mean, I'm not trying to be funny here, but if you hit a co-worker over the head with a tire iron, you get fired, you don't pass go, you don't collect benefits. It's employment misconduct. And so that's where a lot of the decisions are, employment misconduct. Now, an employer might say, well, and what happens is, though, if your poor performance without more by itself is not employment misconduct. You know, not all of us are gifted with the same ability to make decisions, so somebody may have a poor job performance in terms of substantive performance, may let them go. The employer may feel, gosh, they didn't do what I told them to do, but in the context I just gave you, that's not employment misconduct. However, if you have an attendance pattern, you know, you're not showing up for work, that in a pattern that in a number of cases would be employment misconduct. Each of these are individual case-by-case things. We get data from the applicant, we get data from the employer, we make a decision, then the party that did not get the decision they wanted can appeal it, and Craig's area handles those appeals. Now, if it's a quit, it's reversed. Generally, if you quit, you're not entitled to benefits unless some exceptions apply. Exception would be, the big exception would be quit because of a good reason caused by the employer. What would be an example of that? Let's say an employee felt they were being sexually harassed or harassed, and there's requirements they must notify the employer and give the employer an opportunity to correct that. But let's say they did, the employer didn't correct, and it continued. The employee then says, I can't put up with this anymore, I'm leaving. That could be quit because of a good reason caused by the employer, therefore that is charged. Now those are what we call the separation decisions. Then week to week, each week, we make an eligibility ruling. Are you able for work? Are you actively seeking work? We get data from them, the self-disclosure. Did they take work that week? You know, they might have worked part-time, and there's offsets for that. So we have weekly eligibility, and that's part of whatever the number was, 360,000 decisions we make a year, both on separation and eligibility. And I get calls from applicants who might say, I'm thinking of quitting. Am I going to be entitled to benefits? And I will say, if you make the decision to quit, you have to first of all, I never give advice that way because I don't know all the facts, but I would say you have to at least understand you've got an uphill battle to get benefits because the general rule is you would not. I get a call from an employer saying, I'm thinking of discharge someone, do you think they'll get benefits? I will say, if you're making the decision, you know, generally they're going to get benefits except they fall in certain exceptions, but we don't prejudge that decision, because I don't want one of the two sides coming in and say, Keith Goodwin said I would or wouldn't get benefits. That's for the fact-gathering people to determine.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I hate to say it, but the reputation of the Department of the Unemployment is that most of the time the employee wins, and then you have to appeal. I mean, I hear that a lot from employers. Maybe it's more anecdotal, but what percentage of the claims that you get for people that have been released, what percentage gets appealed?
I would say around 12 to 13%, which has been pretty constant. And we have more applicant appeals than employer appeals. Yeah. The perception we get is that those who are employers feel that the employees win too much, and the employees feel that the employer wins too much. So we follow the law. We do the best we can. And but we do have higher applicant appeals than employer appeals.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having been around this program for many years here and as a pipe fitter, you changed the appeal process, the court process, 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was, so you could do video courts and conference call court appeals. And one of the things that has always struck me as interesting is that if I, as an employee, am appealing the discharge and the denial of unemployment benefits, and I'm calling my past fellow employees to testify, they always end up testifying with their current employer sitting next to them, most of the time. Just anecdotal. I can't imagine you get the best kind of clarity with those kind of situations. Do you have anything to say about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we used to do exclusively in-person hearings, and I found when I was doing those that was the same case, is that a current employee is very hesitant to side with the discharged worker over his current employer, especially when his supervisor is sitting in the room listening to everything that he or she is saying. And I think that's just a reality of the system. Everyone testifies under oath. We do see current employees testify in favor of applicants for benefits and against their employer on occasion, but they are very careful to protect their own job while they are doing so. Some employees refuse to testify willingly on behalf of applicants who request that they testify, and we will subpoena those employees to testify. But I think any court faces similar concerns with testimony of witnesses.
Representative Mahoney.
The only thing is that having sat in on a few of them, I'm amazed at the amount of selective forgetfulness on past on fellow former employees, so to speak. It's just amazing how fast they forget things.
Representative Dill.
This is so informative that I just keep thinking of things. Someone, I mean, I've never on all of this time in business for long time, I just never had the opportunity to really sit down and ask these questions. And I think about a person that works, let's just make an example, and I hate to give specific examples, but a person that works for a family business at a resort in Ely, Minnesota, and gets laid off by his parents, and he, under this bill, would be able to receive the traditional benefits, but then he enrolls in college so he can better himself. What happens to his benefits?
You are really making us work today.
So 10-minute presentation, huh? Pardon?
First of all, generally, if there is something called certified training. So if you're certified by the dislocated worker unit, then you can go to college full-time and pursue that. Most individuals, however, and this works now with the new online learning systems that exist at colleges, you just can't decide I'm going to go and become a PhD in chemistry and get a year of unemployment, or now 86 weeks. You have to be willing to, you have to look for work, and you have to be willing to quit if a suitable job comes along. So used to be that when we were more semester-based lockdown education systems, that was a real big challenge once you enrolled in school. But now today, with all the learning modules, and you can do it anytime, you can do it online, you can do it at night, the law was changed a year or two ago. Craig, I'm sure, is probably already getting it, to permit payment of benefits because they have the ability to get educational at different time frames. So we're more fluid. Yeah. And if you talk to the educators today, meaning the colleges and universities and vocational schools, they're very much committed to trying to work around these kinds of issues and much more online. So you can do both, work and get an education.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dill, under Representative Rukavina, we had this come up a lot during the significant unemployment that came over with the recession. I mean, a lot of people that were trying to get to better themselves, and what was happening is, because of the strict wording of the law, they actually had to quit. We managed to change that. I can't remember. I think you were on the bill. I think Representative Rukavina, myself. And then we actually tossed in there that the schools have to make a reasonable effort to restructure the class for that person so they can finish, at least finish the quarter, semester, or whatever it was that they were on, so that they can continue to get better themselves and hopefully get a different type of job or better pay.
So we can have a better trained workforce. Any other questions? Well, this has been very informative. Craig, your 10 minutes did grow, and I think everybody benefited from your answers and from the questions. I think we all are much more informed right now than we would have been without them. So I appreciate all that, and with that, this meeting is adjourned.